Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Reports of hundreds of fatalities from bombing in southern Gaza at the weekend heightened deep alarm over the plight of civilians there, while UN humanitarians said that aid access to the north was entirely blocked. The latest update from the UN Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, confirmed rising casualties and devastation amid heavy Israeli bombardment from air, land and sea. OCHA said that at least 316 people were killed and at least another 664 injured in Gaza from Saturday the 2nd of December through Sunday the 3rd. An Israeli soldier was also reportedly killed in the enclave at the weekend, and another succumbed to wounds sustained previously, the UN Aid Office update said. COP28 news now from Dubai, where advocates calling for funding to help developing countries withstand climate shocks have been highlighting the devastating impact on their communities, and in particular on youngsters and women. Senegalese singer and rapper Oumi Gaye, whose stage name is OMG, told delegates that she embraced climate action after her grandparents' home was destroyed by rising seas. She's been collaborating with UN Aid Coordination Office OCHA to advocate for humanitarian causes in the Sahel, which is seeing one of the world's fastest growing humanitarian emergencies. Ms. Gay is part of the My Sahel project, whose proceeds are split between the contributing artists and the OCHA-managed Humanitarian Fund for West and Central Africa. Senegal already faces hotter temperatures and rising sea levels, which are destroying livelihoods and homes, driving poverty, violence, and fueling migration across perilous routes. According to the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, some 3.5 billion people, which is nearly half the world's population, live in areas that are highly vulnerable to climate change. And staying with climate news, flooding in Somalia has uprooted more than 1 million people and killed 110, UN humanitarians in the country said in their latest situation report on Monday. Rising waters caused by torrential downpours have actually affected more than 2.4 million people in the East African nation, while UN aid teams are increasingly concerned about the spread of waterborne diseases. Suspected cases of cholera have already been reported, and humanitarians have highlighted how much of a threat this poses to communities with only limited healthcare support. UN and partner humanitarian organizations, authorities and locals have assisted at least 820,000 people in need, with at least 37 boats deployed to deliver supplies or evacuate trapped people. To date, the 2023 Humanitarian Response Plan for Somalia, which requires $2.6 billion to help 7.6 million of Somalia's most vulnerable people, is only 42% funded. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This news is funded by viewers like you. Please support our work at democracynow.org/give. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit here in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The World Health Organization says the situation in Gaza is worsening by the hour, as Israel's military lays siege to hospitals and intensifies its assaults on areas it previously ordered the civilians to flee to. The death toll from the Israeli bombardment is approaching 16,000, with thousands more believed to be trapped under the rubble. 26 of Gaza's 35 hospitals are now out of service. In the north, Israeli tanks encircle Kamal Adwan Hospital and began shelling the medical complex. Doctors say Israeli snipers are firing on anyone attempting to leave. Images from the hospital's courtyard show bodies swaddled in white sheets lined up in rows after medical staff were unable to bury the dead. In southern Gaza, an intense Israeli assault on the city of Khan Yunis has left hospitals overrun. This is Ibrahim Esbetan, whose two-month-old son was injured in Israeli airstrike on Monday.
They told us to leave Gaza City. There's a war in Gaza, so we left the north and came here to the south, just like they asked. But this is what we found in the south. What can we do? This is my son. He was born on the second day of the war, and we haven't been able to register his birth yet.
As he spoke, Ibrahim Espeyton gestured to his infant son, who lay motionless while medical workers connected him to an oxygen supply. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, has called Gaza the most dangerous place in the world to be a child. More than three quarters of Gaza's population is displaced, with some 2 million people forced into a 90 square mile area in the south, which Israel is actively bombing. Among the dead is Sofyan Taya, president of the Islamic University of Gaza, a renowned researcher in physics and applied mathematics. Taya was killed along with his family in an Israeli airstrike Saturday in Jabalia, just north of Gaza City. On Monday, Israel cut phone and internet access across Gaza for the fourth time, plunging most of Gaza's residents into another total communications blackout. This comes as Israeli attacks continue to kill journalists at an unprecedented pace. On Friday, Montazar Al-Sawaf, a freelance journalist working for the Turkish Anadolu agency, was killed along with his brother and other relatives in an Israeli airstrike on his home. Al-Sawaf reportedly bled to death after no ambulances were available to save him. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 56 Palestinian media workers have been killed by Israeli forces since October 7th. In Washington, D.C., State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said Monday, it's too soon to judge whether Israel has been doing enough to protect civilians in Gaza. Miller was challenged by veteran Palestinian journalist Saeed Arakat.
We think far too many I have not seen evidence that they are intentionally killing civilians. We believe that far too many civilians have been killed. But again, this goes back to the underlying problem of this entire situation, which is that Hamas has embedded itself inside civilian homes, inside mosques, in schools, in churches. It is Hamas that is putting these civilians in harm's way.
A court in the Netherlands has heard a lawsuit brought by human rights groups challenging the government's export of F-35 fighter jet parts to Israel. Oxfam and Amnesty International argue the arms transfer violates the Netherlands' obligations under international law to prevent war crimes, citing Israel's wide-scale and serious violations of humanitarian law in Gaza. Dutch human rights lawyer Lisbeth Zegveld argued the case.
The state must immediately stop its deliveries of F-35 parts to Israel, that it is its obligation under Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions. It is its obligation under the Genocide Treaty to prevent genocide, and it is its obligation under export law. The position of the state that we can't confidently establish whether violations are taking place is a charade.
A ruling in the case is expected in 2 weeks. In Tanzania, at least 63 people have been killed since torrential rains over the weekend triggered flooding and mudslides. On Monday, Tanzania's President Samia Suluhu Hassan cut short her trip to the COP28 climate summit to oversee her government's response to the disaster. Since October, persistent heavy rains across East Africa have killed at least 350 people and displaced about 1 million residents of Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, and Tanzania. A new report by the Global Carbon Project finds greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels soared to a new record high this year, with carbon dioxide releases approaching nearly 41 billion metric tons. Despite dire warnings over the rapid acceleration of the climate crisis, humanity has burned coal, oil, and gas at a faster pace in 2023 than it did last year. Here in Dubai, a new analysis finds nearly 2,500 fossil fuel lobbyists have been credentialed to attend this year's COP28 UN Climate Summit. That's nearly four times as many industry lobbyists as attended last year's COP27 summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. This is Drew Slatter of the group Pacific Climate Warrior speaking during a COP28 event on Monday.
We can achieve a phase-out of fossil fuels. We can achieve 100% renewable energy. We can achieve a fair and efficient finance package for the energy transition in the Pacific. But the obscene number of big polluters at these climate negotiations threatens that. In Glasgow, fossil fuel lobbyists outnumbered Pacific delegates 12 to 1. If I'm not wrong, last year the number rose to 15 to 1. And the number this year is expected to be even higher.
Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Rachel Rose Jackson, the Director of Climate Research and Policy at Corporate Accountability, part of the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition, which authored the report, Record Number of Fossil Fuel Lobbyists at COP28. In Aurora, Colorado, a trial is underway of two paramedics who faced criminal charges over the 2021 death of Elijah McClain. Police videos show Jeremy Cooper and Peter Chichinek injected McClain with the powerful sedative ketamine after police arrested him and placed him in a dangerous carotid hold as he was walking home from a grocery store. McClain suffered a cardiac arrest within minutes of being injected and died days later. A pulmonary critical care specialist testified there was no reason to give McClain ketamine. Elijah McClain was in his 20s. Prosecutors also accused the paramedics of neglecting to assist McClain after they drugged him and he lay dying on the ground. Meanwhile, Aurora police officer Nathan Woodyard, who was acquitted last month of homicide and manslaughter charges in McClain's death, returned to work after a two-year suspension, receiving over $200,000 in back pay. Federal agents in Miami, Florida, have arrested a former State Department official who once served as U.S. ambassador to Bolivia, accusing him of working as an agent of the Cuban government for more than four decades. On Monday, Justice Department officials said Victor Manuel Rocha sought out and obtained positions within the U.S. government that would provide him with access to non-public information to pass along to Havana. However, the charging document reveals few details about what information Rocha might have shared with the Cuban government. And the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on Monday in a case challenging Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy plan, which shields members of the billionaire Sackler family from civil liability over their role in creating and fueling the opioid epidemic. In 2019, Purdue filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection as it faced thousands of lawsuits seeking trillions of dollars in compensation from the Sacklers, who profited from selling the highly addictive drug OxyContin while fully aware it was directly fueling the opioid epidemic in America. According to the CDC, opioid overdoses have killed over 500,000 people in the United States over the past 20 years. Outside the Supreme Court Monday, family members held photos of loved ones lost to the opioid crisis. This is Rebecca Finnerty, whose son died of an overdose in 2016.
They were all little slaps on the wrist with little financial fines. And if that continues, there's really no real justice here for what's happened in this country. There are hundreds of thousands of lives that are gone, and a fine doesn't do it. And hiding behind bankruptcy protection because you're a billionaire, they're worth $11 billion. And it's ridiculous that they profited off the deaths of our children and are walking away with that.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Dubai in the United Arab Emirates at the UN Climate Summit. Democracy Now! Is funded by viewers like you. Please give today at democracynow.org/give.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, abortion politics reveal concerns, was the headline one paper gave a recent AP story, language so bland it almost discourages reading the piece. which reports how right-wingers and anti-abortion activists are seeking to undermine or undo democratic processes themselves when those processes accurately reflect the public desire to protect reproductive rights. Methods include, quote, challenging election results, refusing to bring state laws into line with voter-backed changes, moving to strip state courts of their power to consider abortion-related laws, and challenging the citizen-led ballot initiative process itself, close quote. So there is a way to cover abortion access as a political issue without reducing it to one. But too many outlets seem to have trouble shaking the framing of abortion as a controversy or as posing problems for this or that politician, rather than presenting it as a matter of basic human rights that majorities in this country have long supported and centering in their coverage the people who are being affected by its creeping criminalization. Melissa Jira Grant is a staff writer at The New Republic and the author of Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work, and of the forthcoming A Woman is Against the Law, Sex, Race, and the Limits of Justice in America. She's been reporting on abortion for years and joins us this week to talk about it. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. The Washington Post editorial board is worried. A November 22nd editorial warned, if attitudes don't shift, a political dating mismatch will threaten marriage. The Post has identified a growing ideological divide between single young men and women, with far more women identifying as liberal, a gap that's particularly pronounced among Gen Z white people, the board takes care to point out. Add to that a survey of college students that found 71% of Democrats would not date someone with opposing views, and the Post says you find yourself with a mismatch that means, quote, someone will need to compromise, close quote. And since it's Democrats saying they won't date Republicans, well, that would mean the young liberal women are the ones who need to do the compromising. Julie Holler and Jim Narikas wrote about this for fair.org, but just know that a major source for this hand-wringing weirdness is the Institute for Family Studies. The right-wing group, whose senior fellow, Brad Wilcox, also cited, was involved in discredited anti-same-sex marriage research a decade ago. The numbers don't show what they say they do. But the data don't seem to be the point in an editorial about how the collapse of American marriage is imminent unless young liberal women stop being so political and uncompromising. The board sniffs, quote, unfortunately, Americans have not equipped themselves to discuss, debate, and reason across these divides, close quote. Is the problem maybe the side of the divide that's committed to a whole different reality that permits no reasoning and criminalizes the expression of ideas it disagrees with? No. Quote, particularly on college campuses, a culture of seeking sameness has set up young Americans for disappointment, close quote. The link there, tellingly, goes to another Post editorial advising universities to shut up about issues like institutional and structural racism and reproductive freedom. People's insight and understanding about the world, the Post says, often come from considering alternative perspectives that may at first seem odd or offensive. What's odd or offensive to a young liberal woman surely includes things like the outright misogyny that the Post acknowledges is popular among some boys and young men. But instead of centering the solutions on things like combating such misogyny in our culture, the Post instead says women should suck it up and open their minds to those perspectives, lest they bring on the collapse of American marriage. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Supreme Court's overturning of Roe versus Wade has generated well-grounded fear and confusion. States ginning up their own specific laws and attempting to extend them to other states. Politicians and pundits attempting to shift opinion through rhetoric
It's not a ban. It's a standard. And what about abortion tourism? Combined with horrific emerging stories of women being forced to labor through dangerous complications, it adds up to an unclear but clearly disturbing situation and to a crying need for reporting with an overt fealty to human rights rather than a lazy and cowardly both sidesing of a shifting terrain. Melissa Jira Grant is a staff writer at the New Republic and the author of Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work from Verso, and of A Woman is Against the Law, Sex, Race, and the Limits of Justice in America, which is forthcoming from Little Brown. She's co-director of the film They Won't Call It Murder, about police murders in Columbus, Ohio, from Field of Vision. And she joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, Melissa Jira Grant.
Thank you so much for having me.
I would like to start by situating a story that some listeners will have heard about a case in Idaho where the mother of a 15-year-old accused the girl's boyfriend and his mother of taking the girl across state lines to obtain an abortion. Folks may have heard that prosecutors applied trafficking laws here, but that wasn't quite right. But it isn't that some legislators aren't trying to criminalize interstate travel for abortions. So we don't want to miss the forest for the trees. Would you tease out, to the extent that you think it's meaningful, the bit here about some initial misreporting from the reality of the problem that folks are worrying about?
Sure. I think it starts with just a real sense of urgency, a legitimate sense of urgency. After years, particularly in feminist media and for folks who've been covering abortion rights for a long time, journalists have been hearing from other journalists that, like, Roe's not going anywhere, don't you worry, you know, it's just kind of this patronizing thing. And isn't it sad that now we're in this moment and people who have that expertise are having to deal with this whole national terrain of stories, different things happening in different states to different people? The story of a post-Roe world is a very fractured story. There's no single story. But the biggest fear, I think, is that after the Dobbs decision came down in 2022, there would be an increase in the criminal punishment of people seeking abortions, people having abortions, and people helping people have abortions. And that's what looks like is going on in this story in Idaho. It looks like when a mother initiated this criminal investigation into her daughter's boyfriend and the boyfriend's mother, it seems like what was seen as a problem was not just that they had had a relationship when she was underage or that she had run away or something like that. There's definitely some of that in the background. The problem that's identified is they took her across state lines for an abortion. What makes this unique is that the state in which this happened, Idaho, was the first state after Dobbs to pass a law creating this crime that never existed before of abortion trafficking. And it simply means going across state lines to have an abortion. Idaho is almost a zero access state, but nearby in Washington and Oregon, you do have the possibility of accessing surgical abortion. So that sort of sets the stage here, I think, for a lot of confusion, because this girl's boyfriend and mother, while it looks like they were criminalized for the act of taking her across state lines for an abortion, or simply being the people who at her request took her across state lines for an abortion, it's not entirely clear.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't use the abortion trafficking law against them. They used an existing statute on kidnapping, but mentioned abortion in the news stories that came out about the case. And so it was very easy for people to say, this is the first use of this law. It's happening. This thing we were really scared about is happening. But the reality was a lot more complicated. And we still don't know all of the facts, but I understand the need to sort of urgently let people know when the criminalization of abortion is ramping up at the speed that it is. it's not the speed of journalism. Journalism needs to be a lot more slow and deliberate than the speed of the criminal punishment system attacking people for having an abortion.
What we don't want to be lost, it's not that there's no reason to fear prosecutors and politicians using laws and charges that maybe don't specifically mention abortion, but that still are used to criminalize access to abortion. And you've written about that a lot. So it is a larger story. It's not just an anecdote. It's a real story about the use of laws, including the Mann Act, which a lot of people will think is a blast from the past, to criminalize abortion access. Yeah.
Yeah, this has been going on even when we had the protections of Roe, is that you would find examples and groups like Pregnancy Justice and If, When, How, Reproductive Justice lawyers have done extensive research going back 20 years or so, looking at how people have been prosecuted for their own abortion, even though abortion was legal where they had that abortion. And there's lots of charges that can be weaponized in this way. Charges related to disposal of fetal remains, for example, in one case, in several cases. One that I wrote about in Georgia in 2015 involved a woman who had taken misoprostol, an abortion-inducing drug. When she went to the hospital seeking care, they reported her, and the police arrested her out of her bed and charged her with malice murder of the fetus. She was also charged with using drugs while pregnant. And, you know, that's another common charge that we see, you know, people trying to find ways to punish people for having an abortion, even though by the letter of the law, they're not supposed to be able to do that. And I think because this is such a complicated question, there's no one law that's being used, right? You can't just look for like everybody who's been charged with this crime. It involves getting into this much more political and nuanced story about what prosecutors do with the law, what they think they can get away with. And that's different in different places. You know, in the Idaho example that we began with, that prosecutor now is out in the press saying, oh no, this has nothing to do with the abortion. The abortion has nothing to do with the case. Who knows if that's true or not? Mm-hmm. But it is good for people to know that this incident didn't need the abortion trafficking law to result in criminal punishment for this abortion. And I think that's a nuance that just isn't coming across in most reporting. Certainly people who cover the criminal legal system a lot see that all the time. But because that kind of reporting and reporting on abortion are often siloed from one another, we aren't learning across issues of, you know, what it is to sort of deal with a prosecutor in a politicized case and what power they have with the law that exceeds like what many of us might think the law could actually do to us.
Absolutely. And you note it as one of many things, calling for an appreciation of the power of storytelling, of the way that we present these issues to people. And you make a point that we've talked about on Counterspin, which is if you just read newspapers, you might think of abortion as like there's two sides. It's an issue. We're going to see who wins. And the reality is so much more complicated. And in fact, reproductive rights advocates and providers have never believed that Roe was enough to truly protect all people's ability to access abortion. I mean, the Hyde Amendment itself would tell you that. But they also didn't think the overturning of Roe was going to shut down all of their work, you know, but kind of the main idea presented by a lot of politicians and by corporate media is that abortion comes down to electoral politics or Supreme Court rulings. And that's just always been misleading, hasn't it, about where this actual fight is?
Yeah, it really says something about mainstream political media's value of the lives of women or anyone who has an abortion, mm-hmm. how, you know, reproductive rights are seen within the broader context of politics in the United States, that this has truly been treated as a separate special issue that doesn't have very much to do with people who actually need abortions. It's mostly about voters, mm-hmm. right? Or it's about the Supreme Court and what voters think about what's going to happen at the Supreme Court. It's about something transactional that has nothing to do with the actual abortion itself. Maybe that's because there's still places in media where there's a reluctance to even say the word abortion. We have a president who's reluctant to say the word abortion.
Right.
So the reality of what it is to even have an abortion, what that entails, is something that has to be consciously brought into every story about this. One of the people that I really admire and how she does this is Renee Bracey Sherman, who is the co-executive director of a group called We Testify that does abortion storytelling work. That's how they do their advocacy. And when she testified in Congress earlier this year, or may have been the end of last year, I'm not 100% sure, but sometime since the Dobbs decision came down, in her testimony, she actually verbally gave the instructions for how to use medication for an abortion, how to use misoprostol and mifepristone. And so that's in the congressional record now. That's on C-SPAN. Like, that is information that could be considered against the law to share in some states. The degree to which information is powerful here, I think, isn't quite fully appreciated. And what that also means is that every story kind of feels like people are reinventing the wheel, particularly in mainstream outlets, that, you know, there has been incredible reporting from outlets like Rewire, formerly RH Reality Check, from outlets like Bitch, which is no longer, outlets like Jezebel, which we'll see. I think they just got revived today, maybe. There's been incredible reporting, you know, under the umbrella of quote-unquote women's media that has gotten to this nuance and that was really marginalized right up until the moment Roe was a big story in 2022, or, you know, whenever there's an election and an abortion becomes a story for 5 minutes. So the information is out there. It just needs to become part of the practice, particularly in, you know, legacy media. And to realize that this is a story that has implications for people in their day-to-day lives, not just every 4 years or when a Supreme Court seat opens up.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm just following on from that to say how galled I am by pieces. Like, okay, this one's from Stephen Roberts, you know, but still, it's reflective of, I think, a pervasive kind of Beltway media attitude. And it's a column, syndicated column, the headline's Why the Abortion Issue Matters. All right, so already I read issue, so I know that my human rights are first and foremost a political football, like an issue to be considered. And then in the same breath, there's the idea that somebody needs to have it explained why it matters, you know, like somebody doesn't understand why it's important. But then he goes on to explain that why it matters has to do with what's damaging to Joe Biden and whether Trump might be able to finesse a new line on abortion. But I guess what maybe bothered me most was that Steve Roberts says that polls show, you know, U.S. public opinion is clear and it's unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
Americans want legal abortion. They want access to abortion. And he then says that since Roe, quote, abortion remained an abstraction to pro-abortion rights voters. Their rights were protected and their attitude was complacent, close quote. Now, I don't doubt that Stephen Roberts had a lot of cocktail parties with some complacent white women, right? But reporting is not supposed to be, as my mother-in-law used to say, something that happens to or near an editor. You know, you're supposed to seek out the views of the people who are affected by the things that you're talking about. And reproductive justice, of course, extends beyond the right to abortion, the right to have a pregnancy and a child and a safe, healthy environment. It just seems like reporting about abortion has so much to do with who they talk to or who they listen to. And that defines their understanding of what the meaning of access to this right means. And I guess I just want to say, you know, you're a reporter. What would you like to see more or less of in this coverage?
I mean, one thing that's maddening about that kind of coverage is it feels like at its best, when somebody who has that kind of perspective does decide to actually reach outside their, you know, small network of friendly sources and maybe try to contact somebody who, you know, works in a clinic or is a provider or is involved in some direct way with the provision of abortion, they tend to not treat those people with a lot of respect, mm-hmm. right? This comes down to who they listen to and who they believe. You know, the best reporting on abortion comes from people who are not treating their sources like a pump that they can just hit at will, mm-hmm. you know, and get what they need out of them. The stories I was hearing from people who work in clinics leading up to Dobbs and immediately after, you know, hearing from reporters they had never heard from before, reporters who wanted to come by in like 2 hours and talk to someone who just had an abortion. I mean, just outrageous stuff that like I can absolutely hear an editor telling them like, that would be a great idea. But it is your job to push back and say, like, I don't know. Like, right. I think that maybe a better time to interview someone about their personal experience of abortion isn't an hour after they've had one when it might be illegal.
Right.
Right. Like, there hasn't been a full appreciation of people's ability to speak out about this is going to be shaped by who is worried about the legal consequences of abortion, right? Like, we are disproportionately probably going to see people in states that have legal abortion access, people who might not fully appreciate the criminal risks that they are having abortions under, which does include a lot of those white cocktail party women, wherever they live. It's a lot, I understand, to ask of sort of the way that news, particularly kind of political news that treats abortion as just like an issue that we return to and it's time to talk about elections or what voters want. But that kind of reporting feels so unnecessary and so out of pace with where we're at right now. Like, we need stories about this gap between the rhetoric of politicians in places like Texas and Montana about valuing mothers and showing that that's not actually playing out in the lives of people in those states who are having huge maternal mortality rates, who aren't able to get access to childcare. Like, all of these women that they say they're going to support because they're taking abortion away from them, but don't worry, we'll support you when you're pregnant and parenting. And that support is not showing up. It was never that great before this moment, and it's not great now. And those are the people that need more scrutiny. Those are the people who should be held to account. There's so many attorneys general. There are so many Republican lawmakers. There are so many judges. Oh my God, there's some incredible judges with really consequential abortion cases in front of them right now. My favorite slash least favorite is Judge Matthew Kaczmarek. He's in Amarillo, Texas. He gets a lot of cases from the right because he takes 98 to 99% of cases that come to his court. So if you are a conservative who wants a favorable ruling, this is your guy. And he has a case before him right now that could result in mifepristone being essentially delisted from the FDA's approved drug listings, which would mean that it would be much more difficult to get, and there would be legal pathways to it that would be cut off. Where is the scrutiny on him? You know, like, I feel like the frame maybe has to be shifted around now to who the story of abortion is about, the story of people who are creating harm in the lives of people who now have to fight that much harder to access abortion. I think that's the other thing that's been lost. Abortions haven't changed. I mean, there are people who have not been able to have abortions as a result of this, but abortions haven't stopped. They've just become less accessible. And I feel like that nuance is also often lost. It's, again, this binary of pro-choice or anti-abortion or however it gets sort of bracketed out. But the reality is, no matter what people's politics of abortion might be, they're going to need an abortion, or they know someone who needs an abortion or has had an abortion. And access is really the much more critical question than politics.
And I also feel that in your reporting, you've worked out or explored the intersectional aspect and the historical aspect that is kind of outside of the frame of the way that a lot of corporate news media are coming to this, as it's an electoral politics issue of 2024, when in fact it's a deep issue. You've connected attacks on women's reproductive rights to attacks on trans people. There's a bigger picture going on here. And just finally, there's a need for journalism right now.
Yeah, I think it's, I'm trying to think of how I could possibly sum that up.
Please, I don't know. That's why I asked
you. Yeah. In terms of the history, I love bringing that into my work. I know that that's certainly not something that everybody can do in their own journalism, but, you know, set me up to write about the Comstock Act of 1873, and I will go to town and I will find a way to bring that into reporting on what's going on in the present. In fact,
because it's meaningful, yeah. Right? If you're trying to explain to people how we got to where we are, I don't feel like it's outside. I don't feel like history is outside of reporting. You're trying to tell people how we got to where we are, and that's crucial.
And it leaves avenues open to opponents of abortion when those aren't under scrutiny, right? So one of the reasons I'm writing about the Comstock Act right now is there's this sort of legal theory emerging on the right and among anti-abortion groups that we already have a national abortion ban in the Comstock Act of 1873, which was never fully taken off the books and did criminalize using the mail system to mail any instrument that could cause an abortion. And so they're testing this out now in places like district courts in Texas. They're trying to build something that would create precedent or get it in front of the Supreme Court again that essentially says we already have this national prohibition on abortion. That is not getting the coverage outside of a couple of legal experts who focus on abortion and reproductive rights that it needs. And because it's complicated, I get it. But I just can see a story like that, you know, in a year, people describing it as like the law that no one saw coming.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like we could see it coming if we wanted to.
I'm going to end right there. We've been speaking with Melissa Gira Grant. You can find her work primarily at The New Republic online at TNR.com. Melissa Gira Grant, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Well, there you have it, the hottest headlines and hottest news stories that you can get here from Radio Free Kansas. Well, it looks like it's going to be 50 and 60 degrees the rest of the week. Wow. Here. Let's play some old-time music from the 20s of the previous century. And we'll line up John Grant in the second hour. Through my window he comes to peace.
at the happy sweethearts while they sit around and spoon. There's two lonesome people in the whole wide world. That's me and the man in the moon.
These are some old songs, aren't they? Probably drives more listeners away from Radio Free Kansas than to it. This is Ray Miller's Orchestra in 1929. It ain't you, baby.
For my sweetie, ain't you, baby? Sure indeedy, ain't you, baby? If you crave me, come and show it. Don't be bashful, make me know it. Like my kissing, don't you, baby? Ah, now listen, won't you, baby? Speak your mind without restraint. Is you is or is you ain't? Positively and no maybe, baby, ain't you mine?
Do we long or do we play? just a little bit, kiss just a little bit, for I'll say, when the ballad warm and cozy, and the old folks are away, oh, what do we do on a do-do-do-wee day?
See if we can get John Grant on the phone here. Boy, I'm telling you, we played just about all the crime jazz I got to get John Grant on the phone. Telephones are funny. They really are. John, you're on the air.
I made it, yes. I was talking to myself for a couple of those calls there.
Well, I mean, hell, we got to lighten it up a little bit. The first hour, the first 45 minutes of new, top headlines is goddamn depressing. I mean, Jesus Christ, this is terrible, man. I don't know what to say about it. We got to lighten it up somehow, man. It's tough out here. Well, our weather is lightening up to like 50 and 60 degrees by Thursday. Our nights are not freezing. We haven't had to do a fire watch for overnight on the wood stove for two nights. So, hey, that's light. I mean, that's easy on the old man. I don't have to, you know, stay up all night and drift off asleep watching the, and make sure I'm throwing out a log on the fire at the right time.
Right. You got to keep the place warm.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The zoo. It's more like a zoo. I mean, keep the zoo warm. All the cats and dogs. And I got to keep the zoo warm.
That's good. I mean, you got to keep your little friends going there. You know, I hear your dog cat every now and then. You know, in the radio here.
Yeah, they do that. They bug me. Hey, well, so how's weather at your place?
Well, it's kind of, you know, it's cool today, but it's nice. It hasn't been brutal here. You know, I guess the 40s, you know, and, you know, it's like, you know, fall and winter is coming, you know. But we realize that we haven't had snow here in, God, something like 650 days or something like that.
Dude, and, we got a hell of a lot of snow. It's just now it melted off basically yesterday. Well,
right.
Sunday I went out on a booze run, and of course it's an 8-mile drive, so you get a good idea of how big are the drifts, you know. And it was
right.
It was just there were still drifts on the side
right.
of the hills, big but the rest it had all melted off. But basically, it was a hell of a snow. We got a hell of a snow out here for 4 inches, I calculate. I figure it's 4 inches here. 6 inches in other places. And then there's the drifts.
Whenever we have our first snowstorm here, usually it's like 2 inches. The whole place, the whole region panics. It's, everybody get off early, and there's, you know, rush home. And, you know, it's like...
Yeah.
You know, Philadelphia doesn't get a lot of snow, so when it does, it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, here, I mean, the commuters, I mean, we have two main highway arteries into Jefferson County, and these two highway arteries are to Atchison and Kansas City and to Topeka and Lawrence, and these arteries, these highways are just, you know, when it starts to snow or bad weather, it gets crazy out there. I mean, last week of the paper, there were two people. One 80-year-old woman was killed in a head-on collision. Well, these are all on the same highway, by the way.
Right.
Another one was rolled over, slid off the road, went center left, you know. But one fatality and three major car accidents or wrecks or whatever, all on the same highway, highway in that one window of this weather coming. So in a way, we panic a little bit. You go to the grocery stores; they're packed. Everybody the day before, it's like people are stocking up
running
food,
salt and all that stuff.
We got winter weather. Winter weather warning. Winter weather warning. People drive like maniacs on the highway to get back.
Oh, I know.
So, I mean, that's how I tell how people. I mean, in Philadelphia, I don't know how you.
Well, in Philadelphia, the thing was when I came to Philadelphia, I had a brand new 68 Camaro that I bought in the PX in Vietnam, of course, for $2,300. Yeah. So I was an ace.
God damn.
I came up here in my car.
Yeah.
And I got a job at the German Courier for a while, but then I was, you know, then they pulled the rug out from under us and all that stuff, but they wanted to be an advertiser. So I got a job 20 miles north in Lansdale covering the communities out there when they had, you know, the North Bend Reporter. So I'd go out there, drive 20 miles. Well, one day there was a huge snowstorm, right? And the two of us in Germantown, my buddy Craig, and, you know, we worked out there. And so I said, Craig, you ready? And so we went. And I figured, I'm from Florida, right? And I figured, well,
wait. And you're in a Camaro. No shit.
I'm in a new, well, reasonably new. And my stud car, you know. And so I said, well, you know, we're reporters, right? And it's snowing. It's supposed to snow up here. It's the frozen north. And so we'll get in the car, Craig. Let's go north. Well, we drove 20 miles up Route 309 to Lansdale. And we were the only two reporters who came. And the rest of the reporters who lived in Lansdale, I can't get out of the house. You know,
well, they didn't even go to work, and they lived in the same town.
Work.
They didn't even go
to
work.
So I ended up covering a fire, a huge multi-alarm fire in the blizzard, getting my car stuck. And, it was like quite an adventure. But, hey, I was Johnny on the spot, boy. I was there, you know.
Your editor should kiss you.
No snowstorm stopped me, baby.
Even the locals didn't even go to work.
Right. This is the frozen north, pal. This is what's supposed to happen here, you know.
What's wrong? You guys act like you came from Florida.
Right, of course. There you go. Right.
I mean, I tell you, I've had jobs like that too. That's it gets pretty comical when you show up and there's no one's there. You know, I mean,
no one's there. We're supposed to report the news and no one's there. I can't get out of my house.
Right.
No.
And this is pre-internet too, by the way.
You know, back in the day when I lived up in the frozen north in New York State, when I remember snowstorms as a little shaver, you know, 10 years old, 6 years old. I remember my dad, you know, helping him put those chains on the wheels, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the big clunky chains. They bang into the metalwork of the car and everything, you know. It's like, I mean, this was real serious snow driving, man. But of course, now we don't have chains anymore, and we just have tires. And we get a little finicky about the snow, you know. It's like, oh, my God, I can't get to work. But anyway. We haven't had any snow yet. We're 650 days with no snow in Pennsylvania here.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. I mean, but listen, this Florida boy really thinks it's good. I'm quite delighted. We have no snow. My dear wife is upset we didn't have all that snow. And I say, no, Luann, don't worry about
it.
I'm 76, and I don't want to shovel any snow. And let's just forget about the snow. So far, we've been good.
You would think the Medicare bonus plan that they're advertising nonstop on television, it's just one after another. Well, the goddamn insurance companies are out there trying to – you'd think they'd get you a snowblower, John Grant.
Well, my neighbor has a snowblower. My neighbor has a snowblower, and we – very neighborly arranged. We share a driveway, so – I don't have any problem. Gulf War Marine vet, he gets out there with his real chugging machine and cleans my driveway.
Why would he have a problem? I mean, you only get to use it once every 2 years.
Well, right, exactly. It's rusty by now.
He probably is better reminding to dump the gas out of it. His gas has probably gone sour. I ain't gonna start that gas. That gas is 2 years old.
My grandmother Ma, who was quite the lady, tough lady, up, and she lived in New Jersey on a hill, on this long hill, Roseland, New Jersey. And she used to love the snow. The snow is so beautiful, you know. And one day, and we all told her, yeah, but Ma, you know, that road in front of your house is very dangerous. One day, a city bus spun around and ended up in her front lawn.
Holy, a bus?
And, oh, Ma, we always joked then, Ma, isn't the snow beautiful with that bus
in your front yard? Doesn't that look nice?
Right, yeah, right. Oh, lovely, so low, like a Christmas card, you know.
Well, she's lucky it didn't slam into her house, man.
Well,
I mean,
fortunately, she had a big enough lawn that it would stop before it got there. Anyway.
Yeah, that's out here. Well, it doesn't snow that much. But if it stayed on the ground and then you got another snowstorm after that and it was there, you know, for weeks.
Right.
Oh, yeah. We'd go out and find places to sled. And my dear grandmother.
Oh, I used to sled as a kid. I remember that. That's the wonderful stuff about it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I went ice skating as a kid. They had a pond down the street.
I never.
We'd ice skating.
That's definitely New England shit. People out here don't ice.
Well, this was New York State. Yeah, okay.
Well, there you go. There's my point.
Just New England shit, okay. Okay. I can see you have a prejudice against New England out the Northeast.
Oh, it's two ways. It's definitely
for you,
two
it's
ways,
like flyover country, you know. You fly over these.
For me, it's never go there. That's what country it is.
Never
go
there.
Don't go there. Don't fly over it. Just don't even go there, you know.
Right, yeah. So you're happy sitting there in dead center in the middle of the country. You're just quite happy.
Oh, yeah, because I get – yeah, we get to watch the comedy of and tragedy of life just sweep over. It just washes over us. You know, I mean, that
flies
this whole – flies over and drops sewage on us and tells us about all the politics that we're –
right, the 30,000 feet, they always too open up the toilet to empty it over about Kansas.
Over Kansas. Well, there's nothing down there but cattle and tumbleweeds. Cattle and tumbleweeds, that's all. Go ahead, pull that lever. Dump that
tree. Right. It must break down into like a real fine mist as it goes.
It's a blue mist. It matches the sun. It matches the sky. Can't even tell the difference.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, the blue. Well, they mix. you got me laughing here, man. Jeez.
Well, we've got so many goddamn years of Republican dictatorship out here. We just sort of like, well, you know.
I was just looking at a picture of the Times today of your Democratic governor. I had her picture in the paper here.
Well, she's well embedded with the establishment, but she's all right.
Right.
I've met her a couple times. Talked
right,
her,
she better
you know,
be a bit of a centrist. You know, she can't be no radical progressive out there in Kansas.
No, but she puts up with people like that. Yeah, you know, she
okay.
does.
Okay, well
I mean,
that's
she
good.
Was,
that's
she was very good, very very good person to. Be on the campaign trail with. I mean, I was with her and sat with her through several meetings and right by her, right beside her and talked.
Does that mean when you were running for office then?
Yeah. I would.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I
didn't know you had such a brush with greatness there, you know.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, Governor Laura would dispute that. She'd tell you immediately. She's been 30 years in the Senate. I think she comes from the military or her husband.
Okay.
Comes from the retired military, so she's I call a double dipper, tripper dipper. You know, she's getting
right.
a pension from the pension from the government. You know, but she is a very fair. But she here's how democratic she is. The idiots in charge of the legislature, they put up a license plate. Now, this is big news in Kansas, you know.
Okay.
The license, they're going to change the license plate and make it yellow. It says to the stars. The yellow is for the wheat that or the corn, whatever we grow out here. I don't know. And it's yellow. It's a really bright yellow license plate. And she looked at it, and a lot of people started calling in, literally calling in. Topeka and says, are you out of your fucking mind? It, this thing looks like some sort of billboard on the back of my car. You know?
Well, I mean, license plates become promotional for the state. You know, it's like... New Mexico, I know, has a nice yellow one. Has a beautiful sun on of some sort. Abstract.
Yeah,
stuff.
They can make it. Yeah, they can make a pretty license plate. Well, they used to make them out here in the prisons, but they're. But
right,
here's the
well,
thing.
Of course. Got to keep those inmates working.
So she proudly the house. Now this is an. It was designed by the legislature, not her. Okay, and they came up with it, and it was like, and she thought, well, who cares? It's yellow, it looks like crap, but, you know, well, then all these people call
the
it.
The old one? You're talking about the old one?
No, the new one is terrible.
What's
it's
the color
yellow.
Of the current one? What's the color of the current
It has a, it, it's white and blue with black numbers on it, and it's embossed, and it has a, what is it? Oh, the Indian shooting the arrow into the sky on top of the. Capital
oh really? You have an like Indian on your license plate?
Yeah, and then it has little things.
Have you ever had any black for that? Have the you know?
No. Are you kidding? We ran the disagreeable ones down to Oklahoma. They got rich on oil. No, all the Indians are here. The Indians here are totally assimilated. They have their casinos and their small reservations.
Oh, good.
They're
revenge.
Yeah, but she, Governor Laura, she decided that, well, there's too many people upset, so we're going to have a vote. This is my thing about how Democrats, she's going to have a statewide vote on the license, getting rid of that the god-awful one that the state legislature sent to her, the yellow one, you know. And
you don't like that.
Come up with something. No, she didn't. I mean, is that conservatism? I don't know, but she's very... She had the guts to throw it up. So we'll just vote on it. Let's just vote on it. Let's have a statewide vote on license plates.
That's democracy, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, she's a very interesting study in terms of governor, you know, because she's dominating.
Well,
I
think she's big news, a Democratic, female Democratic governor in a red state like Kansas. You know, that's big news.
Which has, and which still has, open abortion clinics.
Right, I know.
Yeah, it's kind of
wacky there.
Yeah, it's people. They just forgot. You know, we're just people who fell off the covered wagons and crawled to a watering hole. I mean, our ancestors are
deep. Is that what the Kansans look at themselves as? Their wagon fell apart about Wichita.
Right. Most of our relatives.
Well, I guess we're staying here, Edith. You know, get the kids.
Died. All the relatives died of typhus and dysentery, so we'll just stay here.
What the hell?
Bury our dead, and then too many got out here, and we decided. Then we started to kill each other over slavery.
Oh,
so,
of course. Killing each other, of course.
Over slavery.
That's what Kansas is really famous for, you know, Dodge City.
Killing each other over slavery. I mean,
of course, right. Wow. Yeah,
All those legends, Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill and... all those idiots, those are just hired bullies, you know, the local
those are the real, you know, Donald Trump showboaters back in the West, you know, the guys that could, you know, had this long hair, this arrogant kind of long hair, and they were just so fast and so ruthless, and, you know, they'd gun you down without blinking an eye. I mean, I've seen Clint Eastwood movies. I know all about the West.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I still wonder why people portray these guys, because they were really just hired killers that the city council hired just to run out.
Right.
To start to the truth is to enforce no guns in the town, in the city limits.
Well, I know. That's what I've seen the movies. That's what Wyatt Earp. You had to check your guns in, you know, when you came into.
Yeah, town.
And the other thing about the West. The other thing about the West and the cowboy movies. Always gets me is Billy the Kid. Now Billy the Kid was played by Paul Newman. He's been played by a number of handsome actors, but if you see pictures of Billy the Kid, he's the ugliest little runt fuck you've ever seen. You know, and It's just, you know, it's just somehow they weren't as clean cut as we put them in the movie.
And it's fast and loose history, too. I mean, it's not – the real history of Billy is pretty squalid.
Christopherson, let's not forget, played Billy the Kid, of course.
Oh, he did.
Peckinpah's, one where what the hell was it? Bob Dylan's actually in it. What's it called? You know the. Oh God, I can't think of the name.
The left hand gun is Paul
Newman.
That's
Paul Newman. Yeah, that's Paul.
Yeah, that was sort of his breakout movie. I guess it was sort of a breakout movie for him. You know?
But it always got me that God, every time you see a picture of Billy the Kid, he's just. The scraggliest looking raggedy thing you could ever imagine, you know, and I'm sure he was ruthless and he'd shoot you between the eyes in a second, but.
Dollar.
Or a dollar, yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, they're mythologized is the word, right?
Of course. And actually, that's something that really fascinates me, Western myth, you know, all that stuff. I've always joked that I'm going to write a screenplay called Cookie. And Cookie is he's the cook on probably a cattle drive, you know.
Like rawhide.
Rawhide. Keep them doggies moving, raw.
Right. They had a.
Don't try to understand them. Just rope them and tie them and brand them. You know. Yeah.
Their cookie was Wishbone. That they called him.
Wishbone, right? Well, my cookie would be an interesting character. He's a guy. You know, it's a bunch of these, and they're all going to look, you know, scraggly. You know, they're not going to be top fashion. These people, and
right.
He's got a history. I think he was involved in something terrible, and he's on the run, you know, that kind of thing. Excuse me. But he's also somehow been around the world, and he's been a chef. And he's a really, really good, resourceful cook, right? He makes good chili. Cookie's chili is just the best in the world, you know? And that sort of thing, you know, and have a, I don't know, just I like working that mythic, almost theatrical turf of the Western myth, you know, and they even extend it to, I mean, I'm reading this book about the frontier by somebody I knew in the past who, you know, this idea of the frontier and Turner, the guy Jackson Turner, whatever his name was, that once the frontier was won, it changed America into a democracy and all that kind of horseshit. And this guy, this revisionist history is saying, no, it didn't change anything. You know, it just, we came to the Pacific Ocean and all of those frontier conquering talents and aspirations in the American soul were not satisfied. They just wanted more, you know. And so, of course, we end up in Vietnam and all that kind of narrative and things. But no, a lot of people write like that, these revisionist histories, starting about the 70s. You know? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all right, let's do a test. All right. You referred to Billy the test.
Yes.
Billy the Kid was like a runt of a guy, remember, right?
Scraggly looking, yeah, right.
Scraggly looking. He wasn't very big. He was ugly, you know.
Yeah. Right.
who's this guy? I'm trying to remember. Cormac McCarthy. What is that?
Oh, Cormac McCarthy. Right. Wow, Cormac McCarthy. Have you
read his book, Blood Meridian?
No, I haven't. I've read pieces of it. They say it's the most gruesome novel ever written or something. Yeah, I mean, it was scalping and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, and the main character is the kid, called the kid through the whole book.
Right, and right. Well, that's kind of a mythic identification, the kid, you know, and definitely he's an archetypal character in the Western myth, the kid, you know, the adolescent gunman, the young gunman, the kid.
Yeah,
I remember I saw a John Wayne movie not so long ago where Ricky Nelson was the kid with two pistols, you know, and he didn't look like Billy the Kid. He was, you know, really handsome kid, and you know, totally unreal, and totally. I mean, these John Wayne movies in the late 50s they were just garbage, you know. That Clint Eastwood movie, The Unforgiven?
That is
the classic Western, addressing the Western myth. And in fact, the ending is basically, I mean, it's sort of not very realistic at all, but it is advancing the Clint Eastwood Man with No Name spaghetti Western myth. You know, this myth, the mythic spin that was started in Italy, you know.
Right, which he began, or was part of.
Right, of course. He was the guy, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Blood Meridian, have you noticed they haven't made a movie about that yet? They haven't.
Well, yeah, maybe it's unfilmable. How about a narrative plot? It doesn't have a plot, does it?
It's really just this story of this kid going around learning how to butcher Indians and white trash. He was white trash himself, and he learned how to butcher, scalp, and kill people from older scalpers, white trash. And it's really, it's my favorite term nowadays, listeners, is white trash. And it really is.
Talk about archetypes,
you know,
man.
Well, I mean, they fall off the wagon. That's the old cliche about dear old Kansas. We fell off the wagon.
Well, I love it, and I can see why it works for people in Kansas as a metaphor of how you end up there. But I never thought of it that way, being totally nailed down to the East Coast. You know, I'm totally East Coast.
Well, you know, y'all come out here. You know, that's what I said. I mean, the New England Immigrant Society started the most contentious city in Lawrence, the bluest, the most Democrat, Lawrence, Kansas. Mm-hmm. It's an island. It's a blue oasis in the middle of the state. Supposedly, all enlightenment came from the New England immigrants, you know, that came out here.
Well, certainly. Those were my people. Yes, right.
That's what I'm trying to...
We tried to bring some light to you out there, you know.
Yeah. Immediately, the town was burned down twice by people. They come right down through here, through where I live. they came from Atchison and Missouri, came right down south, burned down Lawrence twice, you know, and stole their guns and all kinds of. Yeah, I mean, I always find it interesting how the gunplay is always played up as episodic and violent, like in Unforgiven, the movie. But I tend to think it's more like one of my favorite movies, Western, is One-Eyed Jack with Marlon Brando. I think
I saw that years ago. I'll have to check it out. Why do you like
it's
that?
It's one of the – because, one, it's beautifully filmed, and it deals with – interracial marriages.
Oh, really?
And it touches on all these, as far as the Western goes, it's sort of like a what was the one about with Gregory Peck, the Mockingbird. No, you know.
Oh, To Kill a Mockingbird, right. Yeah.
To Kill a it's sort of a Western version of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Huh, that's interesting.
And it's a really great part. It deals with this guy, this rich white guy who runs the town, and he's mad because Marlon Brando is a fly about outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
And he hitches up with his daughter, the sheriff's daughter, who is and he's married to a Spanish woman. So there's all this racial mix-up. Plus, it's it's drawn out. It's not episodic gun battle. I guess it's one, but there's several of them going
check it
on.
Out. I love westerns. Yeah.
It's all based on underlying racial strife and prejudice and Marlon Brando is his only real western that I think is other than the what's the one where he plays that crazy killer.
Oh, and, Missouri Breaks or something like that.
Right, Missouri.
Yeah, he ends up in a dress and all this. He's a killer, you know.
Yeah.
I think he sort of lost his mind on that show,
No, they let him lose his mind. His mind was already lost. They just
dressed up
in a dress, if you will. You
that
wear
was
a dress
when he was. That was when he was starting to become quite a porker, you know. He would.
Right. He's old. He's very old in that, the Missouri Breaks. there's that breakout. Jack Nicholson is in that, the Missouri Breaks. And I think I think that was the breakout.
Well,
the new generation of Western. Clint Eastwood is.
Well, speaking of the new generation, Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. I mean, to me is now. As a leftist and a peace activist and all that kind of stuff, I probably shouldn't like that movie because it's, kind of a little fascistic, I guess, at times, But, it is one of, there was a whole spate of movies like, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in that period that dealt with the West as it was evolving into a modern, with cars, the introduction of cars was always a, key motif in that theme of Westerns, And, of course, there's a great scene in The Wild Bunch where the corrupt, very corrupt and ruthless Mexican general drives in a car. He then gets a machine gun and shoots the place up. It takes place in 1913, a Wild Bunch. And I always wanted to do a double feature with a movie with James Mason in Britain called The Shooting Party. The Shooting Party took place on an estate in Britain, James Mason's estate, just before World War I, and they were on a fox hunt, a huge fox hunt. This is 1913 on Britain, and Wild Bunch was 1913 on the Mexican border. I just want to put the two together so you could just get a place, an idea through fiction, what the world was like in 1913, it was
very
changing. World War One changed everything, of course, but, the automobile and, the outlaws, they had to run to Mexico because, the Pinkertons and all the cops were just getting too effective. And I mean, that was exactly the same plot as Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. They went to Bolivia, for God's sakes. The West just wasn't what it used to be. It's the good old days are gone. And, that's always an eternal plot because times change, it evolves and, But,
well, there's
I love
people. Well, there's another kind of Western, and some people have defined it as a Western. It was Matewan by John, produced by John Sayles.
Another great movie, absolutely. Well, that and was, that, of course, that, what, Kentucky. That, I mean, how west do you get with Kentucky, right?
Is it Kentucky or West Virginia? It's
maybe
coal
mining. It's West Virginia, but the point is it's West Virginia.
Yeah.
It's west of Virginia, right? And so it's not really west, but it's,
right.
You know, it's out there in the woods anyway, you know. and of course, this argument the man was making, this book I'm reading about Frontier, he talks about, some people would talk about the frontier never left because the frontier, even when we got to the Pacific Coast, Manifest Destiny reached that goal, you know, there was still a failure of civilization and barbarism in various places throughout America. There probably still is, you know.
It's still going on, that's right. Yeah.
You look at the Murdoch brothers down in the lowlands of South Carolina, and you go, like, wow, that is the Wild West down there.
It's different now because now we don't have as much of the myth. We have things like true crime documentaries, which makes an attempt.
I mean, right.
Murdaugh, but that is a classic one. I mean, can you imagine? You could turn that into some plantation.
The Murdaugh case, you know, we haven't heard the end of it. It's just fascinating. And, of course, my younger brother lives in Charleston, and he's the one I really have a difficult time speaking with. And so when I learned about the Murdaugh brothers, the Murdaugh family problems, not too far away from.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, it's like what an inbred world that is down there. You know,
yeah. That was a very powerful clan. I mean, did he know any of them?
No, he wouldn't have known them probably, but. Something about the Murdaugh, what they were doing in that township down in, you know, this is Buford. This is Gomer, not
no.
Gomer Pyle. What's the great movie with Tom Hanks that, you know, I didn't particularly like it, but it was very famous, though. Forrest Gump. This is Forrest Gump country.
No, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. See, I spent some time down there. I have photographs of broken shrimp boats and all this stuff. I photographed down in there for a while. I have a friend, actually, with Julian Brown's brother. They were high on acid. And this is the type of people I know, you know. They're in Buford, South Carolina, high on acid, and they decided to go to the Marine recruiter and join the Marines.
That's fucking crazy.
And the guy finally threw him out. He said, get out of here.
We don't want you in here with us.
Well, you'd have to know my buddy. You know, he's
I'm sure.
An amazing character.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes, we want discipline in our lives. We just don't have enough discipline. But anyway, that's Buford, South Carolina, is the Murdaugh Lowlands country, the lowlands, the swamps, you know.
Yeah.
And they had that place locked up. Yeah, and you talk about the frontier Western myth.
Yeah, right.
You know, three-quarters of those, you know, movies from the 50s, the, you know, almost B-movies, cowboy movies, are about the equivalent of the Murdaugh family running some Western town, and
right.
Randolph Scott rides in and saves the day, you know, from the Murdaughs who was controlling the town, you know, from the good.
Well, I mean, that's the way One-Eyed Jack, the Marlon Brent, my favorite.
Yeah.
Western,
there you go.
One-Eyed Jacket. I mean, here's this guy that, the patriarch of the little town, and
mm-hmm.
he's married to a Spanish woman, a Latin woman that has a
mm-hmm.
they have a mulatto baby who grows
mm-hmm.
to be his daughter, who falls in love with this ne'er-do-well Marlon Brando, a worthless outlaw. I mean, it's the power relations, you know, the relationship.
Oh, it's interesting. I'll have to check it out. Yeah.
Murdaugh's that way. I mean, but that's a much more powerful clan than anything I've seen in
Western.
Right,
but my point is, I guess, that corruption can be inbred in a place, and that is part of the Western myth, corruption.
Agree.
The railroads and all of that big money pushing west for commercial reasons. And those goddamn Indians in the way, of course. But it's also fair game for outlaws. It's like, you know, hey, this is the Wild West, man. Hey, anything goes in the Wild West. And so, you know, you get all of these, you know. So corruption becomes a major theme in mythic American Westerns. You know, it's a huge theme. The bad guys who run the town, they have the black hats. They used to have the black hats in the old days, right? And the good guy would have a white hat. Just so you'd make sure you knew who was the good guy.
Right. If you're 8, 9, 10 years old at a Saturday movie.
Yeah,
night,
you got exactly. Roy Rogers Roy Rogers is the prettiest horse out there, you know. Oh God, his trigger is so nice looking, man. He dances, does all kinds of cool stuff, you know.
I always thought Dale Evans was a bit stuck up to be married to Roy Rogers. You know, I just thought that didn't make any sense to me. Well, as an 8-year-old, I mean, what did I know? You know, it's like
Dale was a pretty staid kind of.
Yeah, I didn't like her.
Well,
she didn't want to.
You know, I mean, this was the '50s, and you know, we don't want to have a you know, outshining her husband there. Now, were they married, by the way, or was this?
I don't know.
That's a good cultural question there, you know.
Yeah,
Was Roy and Dale married, or were they just...
Really married? He was probably married more to Trigger than he was to Dale.
You're right, of course. You're probably right. That's cool. As I say, Trigger was one pretty horse, let me tell you.
I love you, Trigger. I'll meet you at the bar. There you go.
When I worked at a university, I will not mention its name or the name of the president, there was a woman, Pam, who I worked with, and the president, every time his name would mention, you know, she would pretend like she was Mr. Ed, and she would go,
oh, my God.
But I'm sorry, that was a distraction. I should never have mentioned that.
Oh, it was sort of a backhanded slap at that university. Yeah, right. Mr. Ed. Well, I mean, this is the thing.
Was Mr. Ed in the West, or where was Mr. Ed? He's a horse.
He's a horse, of course, and he's in the stable in the backyard. That's all I ever put together.
Where was that backyard? In what state, you know?
Probably in Kent, Connecticut, where Henry Kissinger died last week before I could get him on air with you.
Oh,
I mean, Henry
God,
Kissinger
that would have been
died.
A show, I tell you. That would have been a show for the ages. I've had so many people, including my wife, every time somebody she liked died, I swear to God, every time somebody, actor, whatever, somebody, politician, she like died, she'd say, damn, life is so unfair. Henry Kissinger is still alive.
Why?
She must have said that every time somebody.
100 years old. Kent, Connecticut. Now,
I don't
name,
know where Kent,
Kent
is. Yeah, yeah.
I don't either. I looked it up, and it's sort of you know, it's within commuting distance to Arlington and D.C., of course. But, I mean,
well,
the guy...
Well, not in Connecticut. Not in Connecticut. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, why would he...
Well, it's like it would be like 5 hours from Connecticut to Washington.
Oh, my God, really? That long?
4.5.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, it's 3 hours for us here. 3 hours for us here.
Yeah.
To Washington. Well, in whatever part. Yeah, same. I mean, my car now is not as fancy as the 68 Camaro, but my car now could outrun the Camaro. Because these cars nowadays, they are so goddamn tuned up. I mean, I'm doing 95, and I don't even realize it. Holy shit.
Yep.
Look at
my
guy. He's cruising, baby. You know, usually there's a wife over there. Slow down, John. Slow down.
Well, it's hard. I mean, plus, it's, I don't know what car you got, but my son has a 2013. Now, it's an older hybrid electric. And
Yeah.
Do you? Oh, okay. Well, this
I have a Ford, a 2015, I think it is, maybe 17, Ford plug-in hybrid. It's like I forget the name of the car even, but I have a plug which I plug into my house current, and you know, it'll give me 15 or 20 miles, depending on a hot day. I get a better charge maybe, but so if I run locally, it's just I'm running a golf cart. It's like a golf cart. And then when you're on the road, you know, you have a gas engine and pops back and forth. I think the future is in hybrid cars because I think a lot of the problems I've been reading about electric cars is, one, they're so goddamn expensive. And two, a friend of mine just got one, this beautiful BMW, unbelievable shark-looking car. And he says, he went up to Maine, and it's like, you know, it's scary, he says, because, you know, you think, oh, my God, am I going to make the charging spot, you know, and then what do? I got to go AAA, they come out, give me a boost, you know. You can't just get in your car and drive, you know. You have to plan. You have to much more than before plan everything, where you're going with your apps and where the, you know, you go a little out of your way here and there to recharge your car. And, you know, you got to wait, an hour or something for, I guess, these. And so they can be a pain in the ass, you know.
So hybrid might be the better.
Yeah, my hybrid, I'm quite satisfied with it,
Yeah, it's the same thing with my sons. He drives it to work and back and gets 90 miles a gallon.
Well, he's got a better one than mine. Mine, you know, sometimes I get like 50 or something. I don't get great mileage. But,
well, he never drives.
I mean, if he has a small, light car with that kind of technology, he could be getting that kind of mileage. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and it does get up way fast before you know it. Like you said, you get up to 80 miles an hour and go, my God.
Well, the cars are just so tight and tuned up because of computer design and all that stuff versus those cars. And like my 68 Camaro, you know, that was,
well, I got, you know, I got
that was bad analog news for you. Construction back in those days, you know. And
I got bad news for you, Dan. The right-wing radio blowtorches out here that have the most powerful signal. It's every night on Red Eye Radio. The right-wing libertarians are out there cursing electric vehicles, cursing hybrids. It'll never work. Joe Biden is it's all big fraud. It's not, you know, this is, they are bound determined not to transition. I mean, I'm serious. I mean,
I understand. And they, in my view, they have their heads so far up their ass that I don't know who they're talking to up there. But, you know, the question is whether electric cars will be practical and whether they can be practical for one. Like I say, my friend has some, you know, he's worried when he drives now. You know, will he be stuck, you know? So, I mean, these are real issues for people. And you know, because America, you know, based on the interstate highways in the 50s and all this, American development after post-World War II was all about automobiles and moving from X to A to B really quickly and, you know, moving your family, jobs across country, you know, whatever. That's part of the American dream, you know. And sort of the electric car puts a little bit of a crimp on that. You have to think more. You have to, you know, plan more. And think more like a socialist, you know, where you're engaged with other people, you know, and all that.
Well, I still think the car, we're never going to be able to transition out of the car. Not for a long time. I would. It's that cowboy myth, you know. You got your horse.
I think you're right.
You go wherever you want.
That's right. We're Americans. We just have the right to do any goddamn thing we want. You know?
Thing we want.
Yeah.
And that
until
goes
somebody
to the world.
Stops us, like get out there, try to stop us. Well, I hate to tell you, the 21st century, they're popping up and they're trying to stop us. You know, it's not going to be like the 20th. It's a whole new century.
Well, John, I hope you're wrong.
Hope me wrong about what?
About tumbleweed. And we still have tumbleweeds out here, John. We still have tumbleweeds.
Yeah, well, tumbleweed. Watch the opening of The Big Lebowski. It's a great tumbleweed scene.
John, thank you.
All right. Be good out there in Kansas.
Yeah, right. Ah. I doubt we'll ever be good. We're mediocre. Mediocre, that's what we are. John Grant.